As Dobson dropped his wheels to land, every gun in the Navy seemed to open up on him. Tracers flew by. A pom-pom shell burst under his right wing, throwing the plane on its side. He dropped his seat down, hid behind the engine, and dived for the runway. At 50 knots extra speed, he shuddered to think that his tires might be shot. But he made it all right, scooted the whole length of the runway, ground looped to a stop just short of a ditch. There was nothing dazed or stunned about Ford Island now. Some of the men were dragging damaged planes clear of the burning hangars. Others were salvaging the guns and setting up pillboxes. One ordnanceman had to improvise his mount out of some sewer pipe. Still, there weren't enough guns to go around, and Chief Storekeeper Bonnet, a quiet, unassuming man who was supposed to know nothing about weapons, was busy assembling 30-caliber machine guns in the paint storage building. Others rallied around the oil-soaked men who struggled ashore from Battleship Row. Many of them headed for a spot near the gas dock where the beach shelved off gradually. Chief Albert Moulter dragged in a tall ensign, still wearing binoculars, who had passed out just short of the beach. As he tugged away, he saw another man swimming in, using only one arm. Moulter thought he must be using a cross-chest carry on someone else, and helpfully called out that the water was shallow. The man murmured his thanks and stumbled to his feet. He was carrying a large canned ham. The wounded were quickly taken in tow, some to the tennis courts, which had been turned into a receiving station, others to the mess hall, where they lay on tables yet to be cleared of breakfast. Seaman Thomas Malman, who drove the bus that ran around the island, took the worst hit to the dispensary. Once he picked up an ensign, no apparent wounds, but in a state of complete shock. He couldn't speak, couldn't hear, fought desperately to stay in the bus when it reached the building. Another time he gave four colored men a lift. They were all badly hurt, but wouldn't let anybody touch them or aid them in any way. They kept together in the bus and helped each other out at the end, still going it alone. The dispensary was quickly swamped, and the men piled up in the patio, sprawling, sopping bundles that looked completely out of place on the bright, clean tiles. A young girl, perhaps 14, went around trying to get their names, but she just couldn't bear to look. The service families opened their larders and wardrobes for the men who weren't wounded. An officer walked about in seaman's jumpers. A sailor with him wore a T-shirt, swallow-tailed coat, and a full-dress fore-and-aft admiral's hat. Like the other Good Samaritans, Mrs. Pat Bellinger had raided her husband's trunk. Off Ford Island, a weird flotilla dodged Japanese strafers, darted in and out of the burning oil, picking up the men still swimming. Bosun's mate A.M. Gutchen maneuvered Admiral Leary's barge with all the professional polish an admiral's coxswain could have. Musician Walter Frazee, who had never steered a boat before, handled a launch from the Argonne. Chief Jansen brought his honey barge in close, fighting fires on the West Virginia. A water barge turned up to redeem a mildly tarnished past. For some time it had been the crew's custom to give any ship more than its quota of fresh water, if the ship made it worthwhile. A suggested rate of exchange was 10,000 gallons for a big dressed turkey, 60 dozen eggs, with a few extra items to sweeten the deal. Just the day before, such a transaction was worked out with the Curtis. In fact, the turkey was in the oven at the very moment the Japanese struck. Now all thoughts of a Sunday feast were forgotten as the barge rushed to help the swimmers. They were all types. When Seaman Albert Jones idled his motor for a second to spread sand for better footage, a sailor in the water screamed hysterically. He was sure he would be forgotten. Another man swam over and did his best to help. It wasn't easy, for he had just lost his own arm. Ensign Maurice Featherman of the West Virginia lay exhausted on the deck of a harbor tug and didn't care whether he lived or died. His shipmate, Ensign John Armstrong, appeared from nowhere in starched whites, looking as if he had just stepped out of the Harvard Club. Kneeling at Featherman's side, he set about injecting his friend with the will to live. "Mo, history is being made now, and you and I are in the middle of it, and our actions might affect the outcome." Few men thought in such terms, but more and more acted as if they did. Chief Radioman Thomas Reeves hung on alone in a burning passageway of the California, trying to pass ammunition by hand until he fell unconscious and died. The ship had taken a bad hit around 8:25, and flames raged along the second deck. As Ensign Herbert Jones lay wounded in their path, he calmly explained to two friends that he was done for anyhow and they must leave him. On the bridge of the tanker Neosia, lying between the California and the rest of Battleship Row, Commander John Phillips prepared to move his ship from the area. As her engineers lit off the boilers and the blowers cut in, aviation machinist William Powers jumped with fright. That rising whine sounded just like bombs in the movies. By 8:35, some of the Neosha's crew had joined air station personnel in the job of chopping the lines. Slowly, she cleared the dock and backed up Battleship Row to the fuel depot on the other side of the channel. Actually, the Japanese weren't interested in the Neosha. When one strafer flew down Battleship Row, he even held fire while passing the tanker, just a waste of good bullets. He might have cared more had he known she was still half-loaded with high-octane aviation gas. Next up the line, the Oklahoma lay bottom-up, but her men were by no means out of the fight. Marine Sergeant Thomas Haley reached Ford Island, volunteered for a mission in a small unarmed plane. They gave him a rifle and sent him up. The mission? Locate the Japanese fleet. The plane had no luck and returned 5 hours later. For Haley, it was an especially uncomfortable trip because he still had on only the oil-soaked underwear he wore from the Oklahoma. Most of her survivors settled for the Maryland. A seaman covered with oil tagged after Chief Gunner's mate McCain, calling, "What can we do, Chief?" Marine Sergeant Leo Wares found a short-handed gun on the main deck, appointed himself a member of its crew. Ensign Bill Ingram took over another gun that seemed to need help. As he worked away, someone on the bridge hollered down, telling him that on the Maryland an officer was expected to wear his cap when he fought. There were plenty of them lying around, so Ingram put one on, paused long enough to wave cheerfully in the general direction of the bridge. The Maryland's own crew were just as busy. Mess attendant Arvelton Baines, who had been in the brig for fighting with civilians, worked to get ammunition topside until he passed out from exhaustion. A hulking Marine sergeant, nicknamed Tiny as usual, rammed a 5-inch anti-aircraft gun with his hand when the hydraulic hammer got stuck. The men sweated away, oblivious of the flames blown toward them, above them, in fact all around them from the burning West Virginia and Arizona. Under the circumstances, Chief George Hatel was mildly astonished when an officer drew a gun and threatened to shoot the first man caught lighting a cigarette. Men on the West Virginia were even more surprised when they too were chewed out for smoking. The ship was now a sea of flames, ammunition exploding everywhere, bullets and shells flying all over the place. Everything after the foremast was lost in choking smoke. Abandoned ship had been ordered and her port bow was level with the water when Ensign Thomas A. Lombardi arrived from shore leave around 8:50. He stepped aboard and stood rooted in his tracks. Could this litter of clothing, bedding, bodies, and debris be the same neat deck he had left the night before? It was no weirder a picture than the one he made himself. As he pitched in to help the wounded, he was still wearing his white dinner jacket, black tie, and tuxedo pants. They didn't matter, but he needed something far more effective than the black evening pumps he still wore. Then a miracle, he stumbled over a pair of rubber boots lying on deck. And an even greater miracle, for Lombardi was an old Syracuse football player with frame and feet to match, they were size 13, a perfect fit. On the signal bridge, Ensign Delano also had an unexpected windfall in the way of apparel. He picked up the only helmet he ever found that fitted. He clapped it on and checked two idle machine guns mounted forward of the conning tower. They seemed in good shape, so he recruited a young officer, a seaman, and mess attendant Doris Miller to get them going. The first two would do the firing. Miller would pass the ammunition. Next time Delano looked, Miller had taken over one of the guns and was happily blazing away. The big steward had no training whatsoever in machine guns, and at least one witness felt he was a bigger menace than the Japanese. But there was nothing wrong with his heart, and it was the only time Delano had ever seen him smile, except the day he won that big fight as the West Virginia's heavyweight boxer. As fast as men could be spared, Delano packed them off to help the Tennessee alongside. Others thought of it themselves and crawled across on the 10-inch hawsers. When a Tennessee gun captain asked one West Virginia ensign what fuse setting to use, he got an impatient reply. "To hell with fuse settings, shoot!" More shells sailed off for downtown Honolulu. Everyone at least agreed there was no time for technicalities. Captain Charles E. Riordan fought the Tennessee in his Panama hat. Crew members gladly recruited Private Harry Polto, a soldier who happened to be visiting aboard, and assigned him to a 5-inch gun. Men tossed scores of empty shell cases overboard with carefree abandon, forgetting completely the swimmers struggling alongside. But through all the scorn for details, the seaman's prerogative to gripe was carefully preserved. Few seemed to mind Yeoman Duncan grumbling that his new whites had been ruined by a broken steam pipe. Even the twisted, burning Arizona still showed signs of fight. Bosun's mate Barthas and most of those still living stood on the fantail, dropping life rafts to the men in the water. Coxswain Forbes gave a hand until Barthas said nothing more could be done. Then he dived in. His watch stopped at 8:50. Radioman Glenn Lane was already in the water. had been swimming ever since the big explosion blew him overboard. He could have reached the shore easily, but wanted some more interesting way to stay in the fight.